Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, Simon Mundy here. Now, when I first launched this podcast on the BBC back in 2018 as Don't Tell Me The Score, part of my motivation was because of the way sport was covered, broadly speaking, with the focus on tactics, results and the score, particularly of football, which in my view can crowd out other sports and achievements. For example, the miraculous feats achieved by Jasmine Paris. She's just become the first woman in history to finish Barclay Marathons, a 100-mile ultramarathon that is undoubtedly one of the world's toughest races. It's an incredible achievement, but it's not her first, as in 2019, she won another brutal event, the Spine, smashing the course record, which was held by a man at the time. So after yet another superhuman effort by Jasmine, I'm re-releasing our conversation, as there's so much anyone can learn from her. She deserves all the accolades and credits that she gets. Not that that is in any way her motivation, which in my view only makes her all the more special. So here is Jasmine Paris.
Hello.
How are you?
Fine, yeah, I'm great.
Jasmine, you produce one of the great British ultra performances. Do you get along with that?
That's high praise indeed. I'm probably a little bit excessive, really. But
now, you were just explaining to me. So you are, as well as an ultra marathon runner, so you're a fell runner.
Yeah,
right.
That's my
and
background. Yeah.
Fell runners by nature, like, it's not about the winning or anything like that. It's just, you just sort of get on with things. So yeah. It's in your nature to downplay things.
Yeah, I'd say that most fell runners are pretty modest. We don't really like to big up the achievements. So yeah, so the whole sort of response to the Spine's been a little bit surprising for me, a little bit overwhelming.
Yeah, I'm sure. I do want to explore though what everyone can learn from what you have done, because you do understand that it's pretty remarkable, and to lay people, normal people, many normal people, it's jaw-dropping. You understand that?
Yeah,
though?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, so let's just outline. Well, first of all, let's talk about the rest of your life as well. So you're a vet. We're in Edinburgh currently, and this is where you're a vet.
Yep, at the specialist hospital at Easterbush, yeah.
Okay, and you've just completed a PhD.
Yes, I've not handed the thesis in yet, but right. it's getting there now.
Okay, and you've got an 18-month-old daughter, Rowan?
16 months, yeah.
16-month-old daughter. And you live how far? So we're in the centre of Edinburgh now. How far are you from here?
We live about 30 minutes south, so we live pretty near some good hills for running in. But yeah, nice distance for commuting into the city.
Very rural where you are?
Yeah, really rural. There's sort of three houses and big reservoir for swimming in. Yeah. I'm very happy where we are now. Yeah.
And growing up, you weren't a runner, were you?
I didn't start running till I left university, so when I was 24. And but before, it's not as if so I came into running not as a road runner. I came into running as directly as a fell runner. So it was actually a really natural progression for me from walking in the hills. We did lots of hiking with my parents, even when we were really small. I remember our first wild camping trip. And then, so it was just kind of a natural progression of moving more quickly in the hills. And it gave me a way of getting out into the hills every day, even when I was at work, you know, for an hour before work. Yeah. So
you're 24 years old, and then that's when you took up fell running, as you say.
Yeah.
Quickly went into taking it relatively seriously.
Yeah, so I started, the reason I actually started was a colleague, I was working in practice near home in Glossop, and a colleague suggested I go along to a local fell race, and that was just sort of 4 miles and, I don't know, a couple of hundred metres of ascent. But I really loved it, and I wasn't very good at all at that point, so I sort of probably finished two-thirds of the way through the field or so. And that was despite sort of finishing feeling like I'd, you know, coughed up my lungs. I couldn't breathe, I had no oxygen left whatsoever. But then I started training with the local fell running club, Glossopdale Harriers, and I did start to improve quite quickly. And one thing is I'd sort of always go running with there was two groups, a slower group and a faster group. And I always went with a faster group because they went on the fells and I didn't want to run on the roads. So I always went with them. And at the start, I remember desperately hoping that somebody slower than me would turn up so that I wasn't at the back. But over time that improved and I didn't have to rely on that the fellow slow runner to keep me company anymore. And during that first year, my distance, as I started, I guess you start sort of running relatively short races, but quite quickly I increased that. So I ran within sort of 6 months or so, I ran my first ultra, which was, I think, 33 miles. And that was on the back of actually having only ever run either sort of 7 or 8 miles and one training run of 17 miles. And then I just jumped to an ultra. So I'm not advocating that as the way to train for an ultra. But, I was pretty gung-ho enthusiastic. Yeah. And I just thought, oh, let's just give it a go. You know, I was sort of nothing can stop me type thing. So then, so I increased things pretty quickly.
Just really quickly in a nutshell, what's different from fell running to normal running? And then just explain the parameters of ultra running as well.
Yeah, so I think most people probably think of running and usually associate it with running either on roads or paths or so on. Fell running, you run in the hills, the fell races essentially usually require some navigation, not necessarily on paths, so you might just be running between set points on the hills, but they can be anything from a few miles long to sort of 20-30 miles long. But there's kind of a real tradition that, you know, many of them will be based on races that were originally part of the sort of fair so the, you know, local county fairs type thing. So there's a real history to that. Most people will think of running and associated with roads and marathons and so on. Yeah. And ultra running is slightly different in a way. It's a little bit in terms of the scene, it's a little bit of a cross between road running and fell running.
Right, okay.
Because there's not that much navigation. And if there is navigation, usually on paths, you won't be just crossing the hills outright. Yeah.
You were a very successful fell runner. You were British champion.
Yeah, so I was British champion, I think, for the first time in 2015.
Right,
yeah.
Okay. Fast forward a little bit, you have your child, Rowan.
Yeah.
And correct me if I'm wrong, you felt like sort of your motivation to carry on the running to the same degree was waning a little bit, understandably, as you have a new child. So you thought you needed to set, you know, yourself some kind of target or a goal to reinstill that motivation. And so what you did was you entered a race that you'd always sworn you wouldn't do, yeah. Which is the spine.
Yeah, yeah. So my daughter was born in November 2017 and I got back to running quite quickly. So the next April I ran the first of the British Championship races. And during that summer I did race reasonably well and I actually became British champion at the end of the year. But I still felt that I wasn't really back where I had been previously. So I either needed to kind of do something to actively launch myself back into sort of being really competitive or sort of just take a step back. And it was difficult to motivate myself to train at that point because it was going into autumn and most of my training takes place at sort of 5 a.m. So I was looking at getting up at 5 a.m. after having had not very much sleep because my daughter was sleeping really badly at night. And at the same time, also obviously back at full-time work. So it's hard to get out of bed in Scottish winter to train unless you have some sort of motivation. And that's why I signed up for the race, because I sort of felt I'll have to get fit for this race. I'll have no choice because otherwise it'll be miserable to try and run it without being fit. That's why I did that. And it was really good motivation.
Just explain how hard the spine is. So how long is it?
How high is it and how long it takes and stuff like that?
So it's a race along the Pennine Way, which is 268 miles long. It starts in Edale in Derbyshire and finishes in Kirkyetholme. The competitors, you have to carry all of your kit, which includes food, but also you have to have stuff if you needed to sleep out, so a sleeping bag and a shelter. You have to have cooking stuff, so you're carrying a reasonable pack, and obviously all your clothes as well. You have to navigate, and because it's a non-stop race, it's not like a stage race. It's actually the clock starts, and from that point till you get to the end, the clock's ticking. It means that the amount you sleep is a sort of tactical challenge. So if you sleep too little, you're probably going to crash. But if you sleep too much, you're also going to lose places. So all of those things make it a kind of a pretty unusual race, and it goes through quite wild areas as well. So particularly the last section in the Cheviots really feels quite remote, up in the hills. But equally, there's sections where you're going through muddy farmers' fields, you know, and searching for a gate that's you can't find in amongst the bushes and things. So it's like there's quite a variation in terrain that you're crossing.
It's pretty much the ultimate physical and mental challenge. You mentioned 268 miles, and you won it in 83 hours, 12 minutes, and 23 seconds. Correct?
Yeah.
You beat 136 other competitors, 125 of whom were men. Mm-hmm. And you smashed the men's course record by 12 hours. Mm-hmm. And you did this while also having to express milk on the way round because you had been breastfeeding your child, who had been poorly just before you went and did the race.
Yeah.
Let that sit for a minute. It is staggering. And what I found was sort of hammered it home was the defending champion who was in second, who was trying to hunt you down, but he had to quit 4 miles from the end because he'd basically just like completely crashed and lost it, right?
Yeah, I think.
Trying to chase you down.
Ran him into the ground.
But it was the first time you did this race. So what were your expectations going into it?
I think a lot of, maybe some people think that I was going into just sort of trying to get to the end. But the fact is, like, inwardly, I knew I actually was going to try and win it. And I thought I could be competitive. So my training had gone really well and I was feeling fit and good. And I just know in that historically when I've raced, I know that the longer the race is, the more competitive I can be at the front of the field. So, and I've never run anything this long before, so I just had a feeling that I might be able to win it. So that competitiveness helped me when it came to it. Because when I left him at that checkpoint 4, after that, and once I'd opened that gap of a sort of an hour and a half, it was really exciting, that next section of the race. Like, it really felt like a race. And we had people along the course giving us feedback what the gap was and whether it was got a bit smaller or longer. And it you know, as much as in an ultra race of the, you know, that length it can be, it did feel like it was a sort of head-to-head race at that point.
It's interesting that you were confident about winning, yet having not actually even run this distance before. So, like, what was that based on? And you talk about feeling. Why so confident?
That's the odd thing. It's I think it's kind of a contrast of feelings, because in some ways I wasn't even sure that I could do it because of the distance and because of the lack of sleep and but I think the best way to sort of explain it is that if you look at the Eugenie who came second, in second place and then dropped out, so only a few miles from the finish, he I think demonstrates it best, the kind of how close to the edge you put yourself if you're trying to win it. So I think I was nervous about what would happen, but that was more because I think he demonstrates very well that if you're racing it to win it and you're cutting down on the amount of sleep you get and you're racing it with the lighter kit so that you're not carrying so much, all of those things kind of feed into it to make it a little bit more of a challenge. Mm. So and then at the same time, I'd not run that distance and I'd not faced the challenge of you know, managing the amount of sleep and so on. So I had mixed feelings going to it. So on one hand I sort of felt that there was a chance I could win it, but on the other hand it felt like a massive unknown.
So it was like the thoughts were like it's an unknown, but you had an intuition that you sort of a feeling that you could do well. And he was obviously suffered hugely, as we've established, by pulling out. But I mean, you were like going a bit bananas by the end as well, weren't you? You've talked about the trees doing yoga and animals popping out, so you were like hallucinating.
So I think that that's why I can really understand why why he got into the, you know, the mess that he was in at the end, why he got so cold and so on, because you really are sort of pushing yourself to the very limits, your body. And I certainly was at the end. On that last day, I was having, so I was lucky because I crossed the Cheviots during the day, and I really, I sort of finished at 7 o'clock at night. So I really was on the tops during the warmer part of the day. It was just at sort of sunset that I was, got a bit cold up there, but I was seeing all sorts of things as I ran along. I mean, the paving stones on the Pennine Way, you're running along those on the Cheviots, and I was sort of seeing horses' heads and veiled faces, and then I saw like sort of pig in the heather, and the section just before the Cheviots, so we were going through some forests, and I saw a tree that looked like it was sort of doing downward dog in the yoga position, and then it sort of changed into a deer that was like rubbing its antlers up against the wall. And these things actually in some ways were just sort of a pleasant distraction as I ran along. I wasn't particularly frightened of them. I sort of knew that I was seeing things. But each time I would see something for the first time, and there would be a moment where you'd think, is that real? Or not necessarily with the veiled faces, but for example, when I was coming down to the finish, I saw these sort of shapes, and it looked like to me like, I don't ask me why, but like a workman stood beside the side of the road, because my head torch was flashing off these white things. And it turned out it was just stones, but there was this odd sort of period as I approached it. So, yeah, so there's the kind of, apart from the hallucinations, I was also sort of having these semi-sleeps. So I was kind of falling into these micro-sleeps as I was walking along. And each time I would come to, and I would sort of wonder where I was, I'd have this moment of panic of thinking, where am I? And then I'd realise I was on the Pennine Way, and then I'd realise I was doing a race, and then I'd worry whether I'd gone off the course because I'd obviously been asleep as I was walking along, because there wasn't that much running by this point anymore. There's just a little bit, I guess. So for all of these, you know, these things, I think just demonstrate how close to the edge you were by the end. And actually, I got quite cold, even though it was daytime, and I was wearing, I think, 4 or 5 layers on the top and 3 pairs of trousers. I was cold on that last day. And I think overall, my kit was probably heavier than Eugenie's kit, who was behind me. So I think, you know, that you push yourself to the edge.
Yeah, I was just about to say, you really did push yourself to the limits.
Yeah.
So you probably weren't a million miles from the condition, as you've said, that he was in.
Yeah, well, that's exactly why I totally understand how that could have happened. Yeah.
So you finished in the hours afterwards. How did you feel?
I was just delighted to, I was really happy. I was delighted to get back to my daughter, because that had been my daughter was waiting for me at the finish line. It was obviously, it's always amazing after these things to just have a shower. So that was one of the best showers of my life, you know, and the feeling of being warm and not having to run anywhere anymore. Putting on nice, soft, dry shoes and socks. Those are like real pleasures that you don't really appreciate in everyday life. But then doing something like this, it's like going hiking in the mountains for 10 days, you know, in wild mountains. You come back to civilization, there's certain things that you appreciate, and like a pair of warm, dry socks is one of them, and that sort of thing, you know.
So the simple pleasures.
The simple pleasures. And then just obviously having a cuddle with my daughter and feeding her at, She wanted to be breastfed and that sort of thing. So, yeah. And then I did lots of interviews that night, and then we went home, yeah.
Overall, did you enjoy the race?
I did enjoy it, yeah. In fact, in some ways, I enjoyed it more the more it went on. So for me, the hardest bit was the first night when I felt really tired the first night in the way that sort of you want to go to sleep. So it sounds odd, but as the race went on, I got tired of it. It was almost I was sort of in this wired sort of state of being, you know, you keep yourself awake
and overtired.
Overtired. And in some ways, it was easier to just get work through that. Whereas that first night, I felt just genuinely like I just was desperate to go to sleep, you know. So I think because I'm chronically sort of only getting 5 or 6 hours sleep a night, and so that my body was just telling me, right, it's time, you really need to go to sleep now, or you won't get any sleep tonight, type thing. So that first night was hardest.
Then the media attention followed, and Chelsea Clinton tweeted you talking about what an inspiration you were. So you had all this attention, and as you've said, as a fell runner, that's not what it's about. So what was it like, the media attention? And you have spoken about it almost being more challenging in some ways than the race itself.
Well, the media attention's gone on for much longer than the race. Was 3.5 days, and 2 months later, I'm still doing interviews, if you see what I mean. So, yeah, for me, it's kind of, you know, I know where I'm at running, and I'm in sort of my happy place and my comfort place. And whereas doing media interviews is something I'm, you know, I find much more challenging in some ways. But I also feel like it's been a really positive thing. Like there's been so much discussion about issues that I think, you know, are good to talk about. So there's, for example, girls doing sport, so I've had lots of kind of contact from people saying that I've inspired their girls or women in sport and that sort of thing. So I think those whole discussion and breastfeeding, you know, I've been contacted from people saying it's been great to have lots of discussions about openly sort of breastfeeding and raising those questions. So I think there's been loads of really positive things that I think I'm proud to have contributed towards. I think that was featured on the cover of the Junior Week magazine, and I think there's hardly any greater accolade than being used as a role model in that way for the next generation. So that's the sort of thing that, you know, that makes me proud and happy. And so it's, and I'm also like, I'm keen to say that whilst the media thing is a little bit overwhelming at times, I am immensely grateful to everybody for all their messages of support. And, you know, I'm proud of what I did, but I'm also like, you know, hugely thankful to everybody for all their kind words. So I don't want people to get the impression that I you know, I'm not, that I don't appreciate those. Right.
Okay, well, that makes me feel better. you touched on the women and sport. So what's sort of the message that you want to get across when it comes to women in sport? And what's your view of women in sport, perhaps maybe the coverage and stuff like that, as it stands? Yeah. And how could it be better?
Well, I guess, so I think I'm incredibly privileged to have been like raised in a family where I was never made to feel that being a girl was any different than being a boy in terms of what you could achieve. So I've got three brothers, and we were all treated exactly the same. I guess maybe I think very lucky afterwards, actually, you know, in school and university and so on. I've never really felt that being a woman as a barrier for me in doing what I want to do. And maybe that's just because I got ahead and do it anyway. But I think my message would be that as women we can do whatever we want to do. So to just go out there and participate. So and you don't have to be brilliant. It's just about going out there and doing it and having fun. So they say that girls are often, even by the age of 10 or 11, already feel that they can't do certain sports because they're not strong enough or not good enough because the boys say they're not. But so that's the thing I would really like to challenge. You know, it's just about hopefully I've demonstrated that women can just do just as well as men or better than in you know, if you just put your mind to
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. So it sounds like you were raised in such a way as to not have any sort of self-imposed boundaries about what's possible, and that proves that without them
anything
is possible. So actually getting this message across,
so I guess so I've been asked sort of about my views on sort of how much of a feminist and so on I am. I think really my approach, I guess, is that I hope that by just doing the things I can make people realize that what they that I can make a difference, I can make changes just by going out there and doing my sport and my career. So equally, I'm a scientist and I have a small child and I do research, and you know that all of those things, I think, you know, there's barriers there as well for women, but I hope that just by going ahead and ignoring those barriers and doing the things anyway and doing them well, that I can set an example to other women and maybe help other people go out there and try to give them
examples are absolutely key. Without people to inspire you, whether that be close to you or public figures like yourself, they have a huge impact.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional.
Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
In the race, you smashed the record by 12 hours?
Yeah.
Now, I was reading around this, and extreme distances, the differences, the physiological differences between men and women become less relevant. What is your take on it when it gets to the big distances? How equal is the playing field between men and women?
Like, in my own experience, that I definitely perform better compared to men the longer the race is. So I think that physiologically there are definitely differences. You know, in a shorter race, a man is stronger, which is probably going to make more of a difference. Whereas over a longer distance, it's sort of it's more about stamina. But I think that the mental aspect, like I keep saying it, but I think the mental aspect of ultra racing is huge. Like, it's 50% of what you do is what's in your head. So I guess that, and that's certainly not, you know, I don't think feel that women have any disadvantage. So I think that and there's lots of other things that come into play in the long distance races. So, you know, in a short distance race, you just go out there and give it all you've got, and it's, you know, over in whatever few minutes. Whereas a long distance race, you have to look after yourself. So you have to feed yourself and clothe yourself. And you know, and that those things can make the difference between finishing and not finishing. Lots of other things come into play as well as actually the sort of the physical aspect of it.
People talk about the instinct of like being a mother. And also what comes with that is like an instinct for preservation and organisation and stuff like that. A, do you go along with that as an instinct? And B, do you think that plays a part, a factor?
I guess as a woman, so I think that, you know, things like, you know, multitasking, you're not just thinking single-mindedly about winning the race. You have to think about all the other things that lead into it, and maybe
and women are better than
that. I'm not a scientist, so I am a scientist, but not in that specific area, so I don't want to in terms of evidence based.
but what's your view?
My view is probably that women are better at sort of dealing with the multiple things that they have to think about, and so that might help in a long race where you have to sort of there's lots of other things that you have to think about, not just the running.
Okay. Before we move on to the kind of, the lessons, one last question. How often have people mentioned BBC Sports Personality of the Year award to you? I would get in trouble, you see. As we get nearer, I'm not allowed to express any views, but I think we're early enough in the period that, you know, there's talk of, you know, that you're... achievement should be recognised to some degree in that. What's your view?
I think it's quite funny because my friend actually sent me an email saying, did you know that you're like, you can bet against you, taking odds for Sports Personality of the Year. And when I looked it up, he was right, and then my mum said, oh, in that case, we'll have to put a bet on. So I think my mum's already got a bet on just so that, you know, so that she can say she did put a bet on me at some point. Yeah. I don't think it's going to, the fact is the big sports stories are always based around football. Or, you know, the things that people...
Not always.
Mostly. So
not always.
I think it's very unlikely, but obviously...
but you'd be welcome to the idea.
It would be exciting,
Just before we get into the second half of this conversation with Jasmine Paris, just a quick interruption to say thank you to all the people who've been in touch with kind messages on social media. It really is much appreciated, and we do try and reply to every single message. I'm at Simon Mundy, that's M-U-N-D-I-E. If you want to share any thoughts or ideas, I'd be delighted to hear from you. Also, if you can, please give the podcast 5 stars and a review where possible. It would be hugely appreciated. Plus, of course, please subscribe on BBC Sounds if you haven't done already. Back to the second half with Jasmine Paris now, though, and we get into a number of themes, including how to not get ahead of yourself when taking on a big task, the importance of chunking things down, prioritising what's important, cutting out the unnecessary distractions, and ultimately doing what you love and believing in yourself.
The first theme or subject I was interested in was the art of staying present during the race, okay? Because obviously, like 268 miles, long old way, and if you're looking ahead at all that, that's like that proverbial stone in your shoe that will wear you down. So, like, how important is being mindful of just that moment at any given moment, the very step you're taking, the terrain, and how do you go about staying in that moment? You've talked about putting one foot in front of the other.
So I think there's kind of like, it's interesting because I think there's like multiple things you could pick up from this question. So firstly, it's hard. Like, if you're running a race that distance, you can't think about getting to the end in Kirkby at home. Like, it's too big a thing to contemplate when you're racing. You couldn't keep yourself motivated thinking, I've only got 267 miles to run now, not 268. So you really need to break it down. So there's checkpoints in the Spine race that are roughly every 50 miles apart. And there you know that you're going to get food, and you're going to get the opportunity, if you wanted to sleep, and dry socks, and that sort of thing. So, and also just company, a lit room and somewhere to sit down with where it's warm. So those were like big motivational points for me. It was just to sort of, I just really concentrated on getting to the next checkpoint or half checkpoint. So there were some half checkpoints as well. So I broke it down into those stages, and even you sort of start breaking down to smaller sections. So if you if you've looked at the route and you know the route, at least you've looked at it on the map, you can break it down into smaller sections and think, when I get to the next this town or whatever, while you still want to eat, you can sort of think, oh, I'm going to get to this point and I'm going to have this thing that I'm really looking forward to eating type thing. Later on, it's more the case of trying to make yourself eat, so you can't really use food as a motivational factor anymore. Sure. But in terms of staying present, it's an interesting question. Is that, I actually think that some of the time you're not really present when you're running all long races, or you're present in a slightly different way, because I think that's part of the, in some ways it's part of the sort of the magic of doing long distance things.
Is, well, in a hypnotic sense.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I find this even when I just go hiking in the mountains, that you can lose yourself. And there's something about the sort of the rhythmic motion of walking or kind of running along at least at the pace you're racing in an ultra, where you're sort of, it's just that rhythmical activity allows you to stop really thinking about anything else. Or so you either stop thinking completely, or you start thinking in a sort of more, it's a bit like, it's in a more passive way, and letting thoughts just kind of meander through. And I actually find that really therapeutic. So that's one of the reasons I find being in the mountains therapeutic.
It's like a form of mindfulness, isn't it? It's a meditation that you're kind of doing. That's the essence of meditation, is watching thoughts or not being engaged with thoughts and letting them go by. And it sounds like there's a sense of unity that you have with everything around you as well.
So that's why, I think the two reasons that I love being in the mountains is the size of them, the scale of them, just gives me a sense of perspective and sort of makes me reevaluate what's really important. These are the reasons that the mountains sort of I think are good for your state of mind. And the other reason is that I get into this contemplative state through this sort of rhythmical activity. Going back to ultra running, I think that you talk about running for 3.5 days, but if you have long stretches of it where you sort of enter this state of mind, then it's, in a way, it's easier. It's you're kind of switching off in a way. It's, at least for your mind, it's almost like sleeping as well.
So the couple of interesting thoughts or points I think about this are the value of getting in the flow of something, and how that takes you away from yourself. We all get sort of caught up in our little worries about politics, any number of things, but getting in flow enables one to sort of let go of that and put things in perspective and see the bigger picture. And then just to go back to another thing you said, the value of chunking things down. You hear about this a lot, and everyone's got a big project that they've had to tackle at some point. If you think about it as a whole, it can seem quite overwhelming. You're illustrating the power of sort of chunking things down. Are you good at doing that in other areas of your life? Is that something you've always been good at?
I think that if you have a big challenge, that's what you need to do. So, I remember sitting my European diploma exams for my specialist vet status. Yeah, you break it down into sections and you think, I'm going to do this by by this time and this by this time, because if you think about it all, it just becomes overwhelming.
Yeah, that's the key.
And you don't know where to start. Yeah. So let's get started and then just break it into little bits.
Yeah. As we've established, you've taken it to the sort of nth degree, but I remember a guy, a very successful marathon runner, that he would always say he doesn't run 26 miles, he runs 1 mile 26 times.
Yeah.
And that I think that's quite a sort of powerful analogy. And the next thing I'm interested in is how good you are at prioritizing things. So in your life, obviously, you're a mother, you're a wife, you're a daughter, you're a vet, you've done a PhD, and you're an ultra and fail runner. OK, now that's a lot of stuff to cram in,
yeah.
You know, and everyone thinks they're uber busy. But what struck me is that obviously you are very good at getting things in a kind of order of priority and cutting out the unnecessary guff. Like, for example, you don't have a television.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think essentially if you really want to do something, then you kind of make time for it. I saw this when I was doing my residency training. So that's kind of like when I was sort of doing my training towards being a specialist. So working really hard, working lots of weekends and doing lots of night shifts. And most of my colleagues that were doing the same training as me would go home at night and sleep, eat and sleep. And essentially that was their life for 3 years. But I also ran at the time, so I was fell running whenever I wasn't on call at weekends, and it was actually really important for me. So it's kind of balanced out the work. So firstly, it made me more efficient at work, and so that I could get away and go running. But it also, you know, it's good to have something else in your life, because it makes that work then less, you know, less overwhelming, and it gives you a sense of perspective. Mm. But ultimately, I think it comes down to, if it's something that you really want, you'll prioritise it and you'll fit it in. Mm. So whether it's, I say, not having a television, or you find that there's more hours in the day if you really want to do it. But it's interesting, actually, because since having a toddler, there's certain things you can't become super efficient. Like a toddler's pace of life is just not super efficient, you know. And sometimes now, because I've actually become so good at this sort of my life, you know, making everything super efficient in life, I actually sometimes have to take a step back and say, look, you can't, you know, you just have a bit of time to enjoy picking up sticks or whatever with her, you know, and I actually find it better in the evenings or in the afternoons if we just go out and do something away from home, because then all I can do is focus on her, and then I don't mind it being a really slow pace of life, because it's just different. If you're a toddler's pace of life is different than the one I've got used to.
Sure, yeah. If you can find the time to do stuff in all that, like anyone can. So, for example, you've cut out the TV. There are these little spaces in our day that are there that, if we actually honestly appraised and looked at them, there is time for stuff, isn't there?
Yeah, and I think, and also, yeah, if you have priorities, then you sort of learn to just be more efficient with the things that you're actually doing as well.
So you don't watch TV? I'm going to assume there.
I mean, occasionally we'll watch a film or a documentary or something like that. We don't have a television because, from the point of view of, I don't, neither of us really likes the thing of you turning the television on and having it on and then walking past and seeing, you know, getting stopped by whatever. I don't like that. I don't really approve of that. So I don't mind sort of watching documentaries and films if it's something that we actively are interested in and want to watch.
So let's take that a bit even further then. Like, a lot of people these days mindlessly will be on their phones, social media, stuff like that. So I'm going to assume that you're not a prolific phone and or social media user.
No, I think social media can actually waste so much time. And actually, even just that's part of the media stuff since the spine, is that I've definitely... So I, for example, feel that I feel that I should respond to certain messages, you know, congratulations and so on social media. And that's in itself has taken up so much time since the spine. But, you know, I think I've tweeted 50 times or something, you know, so I'm not a prolific social media user. No.
Everything that you do has value.
Yeah. And you have to kind of decide what's most important. Yeah,
really. Right. OK. We've touched on it already, the power of thoughts, and, you know, you've spoken about not having self-imposed limits, if you like. But obviously, like, during a 268-mile race, there's going to be thoughts of like, oh God. So during the race or during these long runs, what do you do about pessimistic, negative thoughts? Do you entertain them or are you sort of consciously fueling yourself with a sort of positive stream of inner dialogue?
Yeah, so I'm trying to think really, I'm trying to just think back to the spine and think how sort of the negative thoughts that I had. I guess as the race went on and I think having that flow really helps. So you kind of, that sort of, and that's part of the reason probably I found it easier as the race went on, because I became more and more engaged in the race. Had a sort of all the sort of peripheral life things that I was still thinking about the first night, you know, about the daughter, whether she'd had a bath and whether she'd gone to sleep okay, and all those things kind of started to, they drifted off as the race went on, and I sort of got my head engaged. So being competitive helps when you're if you're having a bad time. But I think one of the real sort of real things that I've learned over the years is that the more you run ultra races or do endurance events, the more you realise that usually that you have bad patches in like or in pretty much every event you do, and sometimes you'll have more than one bad patch, but you do come out of them and you'll feel better again. And I think having had that experience really helps you, because you you're prepared for it, and then you just you know, whether it's just to eat a bit more food. So I eat quite a lot of chocolate bars. So just as a quick, rapid pick you up. Or sometimes I was singing aloud to myself during the spine. It's actually quite funny, because my daughter's, so we before the race, the CD that we had on in the car was like a Scotland Buck Bugs. It's like it's one of these CDs that you get free. It's great. But there's a song on it about that's like about a train, and it goes, well, I'm not going to try and sing it. It's like, woo, 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 I can do it, so can you. And then it's like, woo, 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 I believe in you. And it's a train, you see. So the whole thing about I can do it, so can you, and I believe in you. So it's quite ironic that this was a song that had going around in my head for the whole of the spine race, and sometimes I was singing it out loud. So I don't know if that's why Eugenie spent like longer at checkpoint 4, just because he couldn't bear to listen to me like singing the choo-choo song anymore. But so sometimes I was singing out loud either as I say toddler songs, or at one point I had the Spice Girls, I think, from years and years ago, and I was trying to remember the song, the words of the song, just to keep myself awake. So that's kind of the sort of thing I was doing. So that those are things you do in bad patches.
Okay, there's a valuable lesson. If you've got young kids, play them this kind of stuff, because it could help you as well. You talk about, you know, you go through these bad patches in races, and I imagine they're pretty rough, but it's about essentially enduring tough times. Now, I love knocking out a cliche, right? So, and a friend of mine always goes, tough times don't last, tough people do. And Winston Churchill, I think, was the one who used to say, you know, if you're in hell, keep going.
Yeah.
And it's having that, this too shall pass, essentially.
And I think that for ultra races, that's a massive thing. As long as you, like, I actually think as long as you feed yourself, because, and keep yourself warm enough, you know, you'll come out of the other side of that. I guess you know, the only time you wouldn't was be if you completely ran out of energy and collapsed.
Yeah. But and you've got your motivation, haven't you, in that you spoke a lot about how you would be thinking about your daughter, and you were obviously singing the songs, which you relate to your daughter, obviously. But that motivation was it's always motivation. Something you could fall back on.
And the competitiveness once you're, you know, near the front, then that in itself.
Right.
That's good.
Something that I think's quite a theme of your story is your sort of trusting of your own intuition and instinct. So sort of trusting of your own innate wisdom. So I've read a bit about like your approach to food, both in the race and generally. Like, okay, you're training for this nutty race, you still would have the occasional glass of wine. As a fell runner, like cake, as you talk about, it's an integral part of the scene. In terms of your training, you spoke about a lot of the time you just set off. You know, you wouldn't have a predetermined like race plan, so you're following your intuition the whole time. You've spoken about not being massively interested in coaching.
Also, it's true, I've never had a coach until before the spine race, but I did I had a friend coach me for the spine, which was actually really good, but it was very, he's sort of my style, so it was quite hands-off-ish, if you see what I mean. I had a plan to do that part, the part of the reason that I that we arranged that, or that I arranged that, was to help again with those motivation in the dark mornings. And that was really good. But again, I sort of it's nice to have the freedom of going wherever I want on the hills and just going.
But that that intuition is a key part of you, the way you approach it, and your success.
Yeah. So I think like the whole thing with like the food. So yeah, we absolutely don't. We have just eat the food. We cook ourselves every night, and do we eat? I think a healthy, balanced diet. But equally, like you say, cup of tea and cake is like the classic sort of end to any fell race, and. My husband loves cake, so we definitely don't cut out the sort of treats after dinner.
It's again the balance stuff.
Yeah, so it's a case of balance. And whilst we eat loads of healthy fruit and veg and lots of healthy stuff, we also have a balance. And on the race, actually, I ate real food. Like, I don't think on the race that length you can eat sort of shakes and powders and things. So it was just, I just ate real food.
Yeah.
And you're right. It's just basically, I think if it was going to have to change my life too much in that way, it would probably not really be compatible anymore as well, because that's part of the whole thing of it fitting in with your family, you know what I mean? If I had to impose upon them strict sort of nutritional changes and so on, I'm not sure that would work that well. Certainly it wouldn't be popular in my family if we had to omit cake, if we had to cut cake in the household.
But I like that you have the odd glass of wine as well. But people there's so much focus on sports science, but I think you sort of show that there's a limit to that. Actually, following what your sense is the right thing in any given moment, the power of that supersedes the ultra-controlled method.
Yeah, food is ultimately energy, isn't it? So you just put it into give you energy. And yeah, and you just sort of do it, quite a lot of it by feel. Mm. The fact is, I'm just doing it because I love it, you know. Yeah. I love the running. Mm-hmm. I love being in the hills. But I also, you know, love spending time with my family. I love eating good food. It's nice to have a glass of wine sometimes. So all these things in proportion. It's got to fit in with life. It's not a career. It's just a hobby. So if it was to become too controlling on other areas of my life, I probably wouldn't enjoy it as much anymore.
And then you wouldn't be as successful.
Yeah, because I do think that the part of the success is definitely down to just the fact that I enjoy doing it.
Well, there's that old adage that, you know, like, you can't be successful at something that you don't love doing.
Yeah. But also, I wouldn't you have to make sacrifices in terms of the things in your life to make it possible. And I wouldn't do those things. I wouldn't make those sacrifices unless I was passionate about it.
That said, like, being consistent, though, let's say in the training, right? So you love the race and everything like that. But there, as you said, right, you've had a broken night because of rowing, let's say. But you've still got to get up at 5 a.m. and leave, you know, your husband, you know, in a warm bed, and you go training. And Scotland, you know, the climate is, let's call it, temperate.
Yeah.
You know, so there are going to be mornings where you're not going to want to crack on. So having that consistency, like, how do you keep that consistency?
Yeah, so I think that's an interesting thing, because I think all too often, well, sometimes I'm keen to downplay the sort of the whole achievement of the spine, because part of me says, you know, I think anyone could do it, really, if they just set out to do it. Another part, I have to sometimes remind myself, I did train really hard for 3 months. Before that, I was obviously running a lot as well. But for 3 months, I really focused on training for the spine, which meant that every morning I was getting up at 5. And at weekends, I would run from, say, 5 till 10 or 11 and do long runs at weekends with a pack. And it wasn't even easy. Sometimes I do have to remind myself of that when I'm keen to sort of be downplaying it. It is a case of, I think for long stuff, it's really just about getting, you know, consistent training. And so you need to build up the miles. If you do that too quickly, you get injured. So you need to do that gradually and get used to the pack. So I trained with a 2 kilogram pack, and then 3, 4, 5, 6. So just, you know, getting used to the weight as well. There was a sort of bulk of training.
Sure. Yeah. And I guess as well, it's like, sometimes your mind's going to say no, and knowing not to always engage with that voice that's like, oh, stay in bed. Like, we all have, like, a part of our brain that wants comfort and to take the shortcut, but to actually kind of...
I think it's easier, like, if the alarm goes, I just have to get out.
Yeah.
Like, so you have to get out first thing, because if you start to entertain thoughts of not going, then We've got a dog, a young border collie, who running is his life, and he runs with me and my husband. Now he thinks it's great since we've had our daughter, because we don't run together anymore, unfortunately. But that means he gets twice the running. So at weekends he gets back to back long runs, which he loves.
Really?
So he's good as a motivational getting out there in the morning, because he wants to go whatever the weather. So he was helpful with my training.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, look. So I think we've sort of dissected it to the nth degree. So just to sort of let's try and recap it a little bit. I think so. Some themes that you've sort of spoken about is obviously sort of doing what you love, prioritizing things, having that balance, and you in particular spoke about being a role model for women in particular about what is possible. So let's imagine there's a young girl, right, just come in here, 12 years old, right, and she's only stay for a minute. Like, what would you say to her in terms of the lessons that you've learned?
I'd say what is it that you want to do, and you can do those things. You just need to follow your heart and your dreams, and don't let anybody tell you that you're not good enough or not strong enough, or that girls don't do that. So they can do whatever they want to do.
Well, look, Jasmine, I mean, it's hugely impressive. It's a real pleasure to speak to you. Like I said, we'll keep an eye out a bit later this year, see what happens around Spotty. But just before I say goodbye, so what's next? Are you planning some like obscenely long run again?
So I've got some ideas for later on in the year. The next thing I'm doing is the World Championships, which I'm racing for Great Britain in Portugal at the start of June. But I've had a little bit of time to sort of, I've backed off a little bit running the last couple of months just to have a bit of a rest. So it's kind of nice to start getting fitter again.
Okay. All right. Well, look, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to this conversation with Jasmine Paris. Like I said, I think there's so much anyone can learn from her, particularly around time management and prioritization, and her achievements are absolutely remarkable. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Get in touch via my website, simonmundy.com, or on social media. Until next time, thank you and goodbye.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.